The great contribution of the cooperative movement was the emphasis on quality. I think the one thing that the cooperative movement everywhere did was to try and set standards and enforce standards of quality. Even to this day, you know, honest value for money, that kind of thing. On both sides, yeah.
The cooperative movement in Ireland has, in the last year, celebrated its centenary. And over the years, its contribution to the Irish economy has been enormous. Generations of Irish farmers and their families have benefited from working together and availing of the opportunities created through cooperation. With a turnover of £6 billion, 100,000 members and employing 25,000 people, it is today a major force in the Irish economy. This was not the case when Horace Plunkett started his cooperative crusade among the dairy farmers of the Golden Vale just over 100 years ago. His vision, his integrity, and his enthusiasm for social reform have been documented by his biographer, Trevor West.
The cooperative movement in Ireland started through the remarkable efforts of one equally remarkable man, Horace Plunkett, the third son of Lord Dunsany, born in England, educated at Eton and Oxford, but very much an Irishman whose practical patriotism led to this remarkable development in Irish agriculture, the foundation of a cooperative movement based on the creamery industry. Plunkett at Oxford would have been influenced by the ideas of social reform, such as Christian socialism and the ideals of Robert Owen, which were going around at the time. Perhaps the most influential period of his career came when he left Oxford in 1878, because he spent 10 years ranching in the Rocky Mountains, and there in the Wild West, which was primitive, just opening up, he realized two things. First of all, that people wouldn't survive unless they got together and helped themselves. And of course, the great example of that was the roundup system, where people from 20 ranches would come together, the cowboys, twice yearly to brand the cattle in the spring and then send the beef to market in the autumn. But he also realized, of course, that when this happened, the export of American beef to Britain would pose a great threat to Irish farmers, and the farmers needed to combine if they were going to export and process their goods in the appropriate way, which would allow them to reap the benefits. So Plunkett, returning to Ireland on his father's death in 1889, attempted first to found cooperative stores based on the British consumer model. And in fact, he opened a store and a bakery in Donrail, County Cork, which survived for a number of years, but ended up as non-cooperative businesses. They were taken over. In 1891, he founded his first cooperative creamery with the help of Lord Monteagle at Ballyhattle in County Limerick. And this success and the idealism which lay behind it, which inspired his great associates, R.A. Anderson, who was to act as the secretary of the cooperative movement for many years, formerly a landlord's agent in North Cork, Father Tom Finlay, the well-known Jesuit economist, and then later on A.E. George Russell, the writer, mystic, artist, and Harold Barber, a member of the famous Barber Linen Thread family from Lisburn in County Antrim. These men stumped the country, preaching the gospel of cooperation to the Irish farmers, and after a 2 years of propaganda by Plunkett, Anderson, Finlay, etc., the cooperative movement finally took off and developed along, based on the Danish creamery model into the major component of the Irish agricultural industry as we know it today.
What was the biggest single influence then on Plunkett's life that led him to found the cooperative?
Plunkett was an idealist, and I think that the single biggest influence on him was the expansive way of doing business in America, the way the Americans had of overcoming all obstacles, no matter how severe, and the outlook which he absorbed then affected him for the rest of his life. And there's no doubt his American period was tremendously influential in his attitude to the need for reform of Ireland's principal industry.
In the late 18th century, the territories of Wyoming and Montana were just opening up, and many younger sons of aristocratic families in Ireland and England travelled there seeking their fortunes, among them the young Horace Plunkett. In his History of Wyoming, Larry Woods traces their adventures.
In the 1870s, which is a sort of a the beginning of the large corporations in the East, the High Plains area in the West was opening up as a place for cattle ranching. Then these seemingly limitless acres of grasslands, which were all owned by the United States government, became available to anyone who wanted to turn cattle loose upon them. And very soon, the idea sprung up that one could have a large operation without very much investment. All you had to do was turn the cattle out. They would feed and breed and produce large herds. And all you had to do was to put some cowboys in the field to gather them in the fall and send them off to market. The grass was free. The idea seemed too good to be true, and it very early attracted a large amount of British investors who spent tens of millions of pounds sterling in these ventures, putting cattle on the range. The story did turn out to be too good to be true, because if everyone can use the range, then there was no way to prevent them from becoming overcrowded. And indeed, that was the fatal weakness to the open range system. The cattlemen devised a system of roundups, and there were two a year. The system worked relatively well. So in the spring, you branded the new calves, and in the fall, you had a roundup which would permit you to collect the steers that now were old enough to be marketed and send them to market. Plunkett established his ranch up in the Powder River Basin, and it was an adventure. It's the only way to describe it. The nearest spot on the railroad was 200 miles to the south. There was no railroad at all from the ranch north to the Canadian border and beyond, as a matter of fact. On the range, the work was hard. Remember, the owners in those days did not stay on the ranch in the wintertime. Once the fall roundup was completed, the foreign owners, for the most part, would go down to Cheyenne and then go east on the railroad to catch a ship in New York to go home to Ireland or to England, depending on where they lived. The Cheyenne Club was an institution where you could get fresh oysters, you could get fine wines from overseas, the finest cuisine. They had a good chef, and it was an absolute microcosm of some other life. It was Cheyenne in 1882 did not even have a telephone.
Shortly after Horace Plunkett arrived in Wyoming, the Americans had started to ship refrigerated meat to the United Kingdom, and this was to pose a real threat to Irish agriculture. His experience in the United States indicated that unless Irish farmers combined together, they would not be able to offset such competition. However, a cooperative based on the English experience was not to prove suitable in the Irish situation. Pat Bulger is the historian of the Irish cooperative movement.
In these islands, as commonly regarded as having started in England, in Rochdale, in Lancashire, you see, where a number of workers set up a retail shop to provide themselves with the necessities of life. And that movement grew in Britain, you know, so by the turn of the century, it was very substantial, you know, and it was a system of retail consumer cooperation that was very suited to an industrial population. But nothing like that happened in Ireland. And Horace Plunkett, of which a lot has been written, he thought that this consumer cooperation would be the natural start. And he tried to do it in Ireland, but the vested interest of provincial shopkeepers was so strong at every level, you know, both in church and state and everywhere else, that he didn't succeed. So he saw the opportunity in the producer side and in the dairying industry, which is in great difficulties at those times. But even there, it was very difficult to start. You know, and it's reputed that he had over 50 meetings before they had any result and got the first cooperative creamery off the ground in Drumcollagher in County Limerick in 1889. And a whole year passed then before his great and good friend, Lord Monteagle, Thomas Spring Rice of Mount Trenchard in Limerick, he made a breakthrough with another little creamery near his own home place in Ballyhale. And they went ahead from there, and you got about a dozen cooperative creameries established about 1891. The principle was that the farmers assembled the milk. They built a processing unit, which was a very simple thing in those days, just to make butter. And they sold the butter then and realised the price of it, you know.
And were the farmers shareholders in this?
The farmers owned it. That was the basic principle of it, you see. And this even applies to the modern creamery. Its first organiser was Robin Anderson. Was commonly known as R.A. Anderson. You see, he was a farmer's son and a landlord's agent down in Donerail. And he Plunkett recruited him in the first instance. And interesting, the salary was paid by the Cooperative Union in Manchester. This was the link with the British movement. A lot of help was given too by people who acted as part-time organisers of co-ops, you see. A lot of them, local well-to-do farmers, you know, gentry and half-gentry, and who never got full credit for all the work that they did. The like of Sir Jocelyn Gore Booth in Sligo, you see.
But Plunkett was particularly lucky, or indeed astute maybe, in some of the main people he had in the early days. Like, apart from R.A. Anderson, he had the Jesuit Father Tom Findlay, and then A.E. Russell, the famous A.E.
Yeah, oh yes, so A.E. was a great... A.E. astounded himself at his ability to speak in public and to draw a crowd and command himself. He wrote to Lady Gregory to that effect: "They have in me somewhere the makings of a mob orator," you know. He was recommended by Yeats, his great buddy, recommended him to Plunkett. "Here's a young fellow who could do this job for you, particularly on the area of cooperative credit." And he went down the west of Ireland and he exposed the kind of gombeanism, this system of usury, you know. He continued to pursue this line in the Irish homestead, which is a remarkable combination of a farmer's journal and a literary magazine.
This was a farmer's journal that whose aim was to provide education and knowledge for farmers as
yes,
well.
Yes, yes, before the establishment of the Department of Agriculture, the IOS had an educational role, and they did experiments, you see, and demonstrated good methods of agricultural practice. And in fact, you can thank the early cooperative movement for popularizing and making practical the idea of spraying potatoes, because although the remedy or the prevention of potato blight had been known for a great many years, there was no way which the ordinary small farmer could effectively do it. He was doing it with a whitewash brush and a bucketful of spray, and it wasn't very effective. And the early co-op societies introduced this idea of a horse-drawn sprayer, which was kept at the co-op headquarters.
What would Father Tom Finlay's role and his contribution then have been to the cooperative movement?
He was a man of enormous influence, you see, at every level, in church and state. You know, he really legitimated the whole thing, and he steered Plunkett in the right direction. Plunkett was fairly inept as a politician in some ways, and Tom would advise him, you know. And his first concern was the credit movement. He was in Rome as a student at the time of the First Vatican Council, and the time when Garibaldi in his red shirts invaded the city, and he was advised to remove himself from there, and he went off to Prussia. And with his natural curiosity, he came in touch with the Raiffeisenist credit movement. And Father Tom, who was reared in County Cavan, said there'd be no just fine thing for the farmers in Cavan.
Can you tell me a bit about his interest in the credit movement and the sort of banks that he founded?
Yes, there were very simple little banks, you know, and very often the local schoolmaster was the key figure in establishing these, you see. And worked very much on the same basis as the modern-day credit union. People came together and saved, and to lend money to each other. And in the Father Tom was responsible too for pressure, so that in the poorer areas, the people's savings were not enough to get the lending process going. And he engineered it so, with Plunkett, of course, was very influential, so that the congested districts board and later the Department of Agriculture would give pump priming loans to the society itself to start the lending process. It was small money, you know. It looks very small money now, you know, £50 or £100 was able to finance and get a whole bank started. It was substantial money when the price of a good cow was maybe £15. And AE had a wonderful story about, you know, these small village banks were only to lend for productive purposes. And he quoted, yeah, well, you have to consider what a really productive purpose is. Where he said, I know a young man approached a bank in Mayo for a loan of £5, and that enabled him to fit himself out with a suit of clothes and shoes and things, enabled him to marry a girl who had a couple of cows and several pigs and a dowry of maybe £20, yeah.
Horace Plunkett entered Parliament as a Unionist MP for South Dublin in 1892. While this left him and his movement vulnerable to attacks on political grounds, he now had a seat in Parliament from which to launch his campaign, involving both Nationalist and Unionist MPs, for an Irish Department of Agriculture.
Plunkett continually stressed the psychological benefits, in fact he used the word moral effects, of his cooperative movement. He saw the cooperative movement as one prong in a twin system. And once the Irish Agricultural Organization Society had been founded in 1894, he spent a great deal of his time and turned his attention to the other prong in his system, that of setting up a Department of Agriculture, a single department, a government department, to deal with the myriad problems of Irish agriculture, because there was no such body in existence at the time. Agriculture was dealt with by a myriad system and complex system of committees, and Plunkett decided to to put pressure on the British government, which was at the time under the Balfours favourably disposed towards his ideas, and to obtain a proper Department of Agriculture. And he did this in a very clever way, because it wasn't enough just to have support from one section of the community, and he linked the need for a Department of Agriculture with the need expressed most cogently by the northern industrialists in linen and shipbuilding and tobacco for proper technical education for their workers. This ensured the support of Catholics and Protestants. It was really an unstoppable movement, and Plunkett brought it to a head by getting the parliamentarians in Westminster and the businessmen together on a committee which sat in 1895-6, the Recess Committee, and produced a report. Plunkett financed the whole thing himself, which was a damning indictment of government policy, or lack of it, in these two areas. As a result, legislation was finally passed in the last months of the old century, and by the end of 1899, the Department of Agriculture and Technical Instruction for Ireland had been set up, with Plunkett as vice president or minister. So he was indeed the very first Irish minister for agriculture, and on the other hand, he was also the very first minister for education. This was the forerunner of our system of vocational education in Ireland, north and south, and of course is the main reason why the vocational sector of our education system has always remained non-denominational.
Around this time, Plunkett built a house in Fox Rock, and it was quickly to become a centre of literary and political activity.
Plunkett was a most sociable man. He lived a remarkably hectic existence, but he entertained very widely at Kiltira. His friend Lady Fingal often acted as hostess, and the parties at Kiltira were famous for their constructive talk and emphasis on politics, and particularly on the economics of the New Ireland. Politicians such as Gerald Balfour and Sidney Webb, the English socialist, came to Kiltira along with Michael Collins, Griffith, Casement, Erskine Childers, John Redmond, Dillon, and Constant Markovich. And they were accompanied regularly by the stars of the literary firmament, many of whom, of course, worked for Plunkett in some capacity. Lady Gregory was a supporter. Yeats spoke at a number of cooperative meetings. A.E. edited the wonderful agricultural journal, probably the finest ever produced in the English-speaking world, The Irish Homestead. And Bernard Shaw, George Moore, Lady Gregory, Chesterton, and H.G. Wells were the sort of people who one might find from time to time at dinner parties in Kiltira.
Lady Daisy Fingal, Plunkett's friend and hostess at Kiltira, was a founder member and president of the United Irish Women, and In 1910, the AGM of the Irish Agricultural Organisation Society drew a large attendance of United Irish Women there to witness the inauguration of their organisation as the women's arm of the cooperative movement and to hear an inspiring address by their organiser, Elise Pilkington.
This is an exceptionally good opportunity of coming to an understanding with the farmers with whom we are desirous of cooperating. I do not know whether you all want our cooperation or not. I do not know what odds are for or against us. So I mean to follow Lindsay Gordon's advice, which I found useful before. Look before you leap, if you like, he says. But if you intend leaping, don't look too long. I'm taking the fence blindly. I trust you will help me to land in safety, to explain our aims and secure your sympathy with them. For the past 17 years, the Agricultural Organisation Society has been improving the rural conditions of Ireland, and its members can look back with complacency on the work done. Following a natural course, this result has been achieved mainly by men. Women have been, for the most part, looking on, sympathising, no doubt, but above all, waiting for the opportunity of slipping quietly into their right place and helping to complete and utilise to the full a magnificent organisation. Men can acquire land and make it habitable, but they can't live happily and prosperously on it unless women help them. Women are alive to the fact that if they do not make their wants known, they cannot expect to have them gratified. And the United Irish Women owe their existence to the same idea of self-help that was the mainspring of the cooperative organisation. Out of the ideas of all self-help and mutual assistance, our association has sprung. These are some of its objects: to brighten home life in rural districts, to encourage the use of sound Irish manufactured materials and articles for clothing and use in the house, to strive whenever it is possible and desirable that Irish women should have full rights of membership in all rural associations, cooperative and agricultural societies, to promote cooperation among women in the sale of eggs, poultry, etc., and in the purchase of household requirements. If you will stand by us, we will stand by you. Mr. George Russell has expressed our attitude exactly. We want to be good comrades to the men. If you will accept us as such, will you encourage the circulation of our rules in your homes? And will you help to establish side by side with your cooperative societies branches of our Women's League? I hope you will welcome us as associates in the grand work you've carried on so well hitherto, and let us help you to complete it. I think you will find it to your advantage to make friends with us, because we are determined to get the better of you somehow. And it is as well to remember that more than 1,400 years ago, even St. Patrick prayed to be delivered from the spells and enchantments of women, demons, and magicians.
The first efforts of the new organisation were directed at improving rural nursing, but soon the movement was providing instruction in every aspect of rural economy, and in 1935 went on to change its name to the Irish Country Women's Association. Horace Plunkett was knighted for his services to the development of Irish agriculture, but after the foundation of the Irish Free State, he and his house Kiltira were to suffer during the Civil War.
Plunkett, because of his absolute insistence on the need for economic reconstruction after the depredations of the Anglo-Irish War, which his creameries had been the object of attack by the forces of the Crown, and then after the Civil War had left the country in a debilitated state, he supported the Cosgrave administration, and having lost his parliamentary seat way back in 1900, as a progressive southern former unionist Protestant, he was nominated to the Irish Senate by W.T. Cosgrave. And He didn't appear very often in the Senate, made one or two speeches, but not long after his appointment, the Republicans, who of course opposed the Cosgrave administration and who by this time had withdrawn from Parliament, attacked members of the Dáil, and members of the Senate attacked them and their premises. Plunkett was in America in the early months of 1923, and his beautiful home in Kiltira was blown up on one night in February and then burnt to the ground the following evening by Republican forces. And this was a tremendous psychological blow to a man who was not married, had no family, and who had put a tremendous amount of store by what happened in this remarkable house. And so Plunkett could hardly bear to face coming to Ireland again. He went to live in St. George's Hill in Weybridge in Surrey.
Irish farmers still are very conscious of the economic war, but I think it wasn't nearly as important as this immediate post-war slump in the early 20s. And as a result of all this slump and the difficulty, that co-ops retreated into a very narrow, uncooperative shell. They were no longer, you know, expansionist in their attitude. They're just to hold on to survive, you see. And a lot of them did succeed in surviving by paying a poor price for milk and making a margin on it, which they didn't distribute. They held this in reserves. And with even instances of a small co-op in the west of Ireland, who in the 30s had considerable amount of money for the time invested in Dublin Corporation instead of investing it in their own members. But the opportunities to invest it, you had this post-war slump, then you had the World Depression, you see the Wall Street crash in 29, and then you had this economic war with Britain. And then you had the Second World War, when there was an absolute shortage of supplies and the land of Ireland was desolated for the lack of fertilizer or good farming methods, you see. And it was 1950 before the new technology of farming and the new developments made it possible. I remember John O'Neill, who was the manager of Killeshandra Co-op in County Cavan. He saw the desolation, you see, of the Cavan lands at that time, and he had the bright idea that ground rock phosphate was available at a reasonable price from North Africa, and he brought it in by the tons, you see, and made it available to his farmer members in counties Cavan, Leitrim, along there at virtually cost price. And this restored the fertility of the land, the new systems then of weed control and everything like that, rotational grazing and electric fences and silage making all came on stream, and general farming prosperity led to an increase in prosperity of the co-ops. Cooperation is an idea that will not go away, you see, and there's always modern applications and useful areas of where people have difficulties, you know, as the economists say, these factor indivisibilities, you know. You see in those machinery rings where a lot of farmers would be adequately served by a tractor and a half. You know, or a muck spreader, or half a muck spreader, or a quarter of a combine harvester, you see. But there's always modern applications where cooperation will make things possible. And that's this big idea, an enabling process of all kinds. You see, we had it in Arnmore, an island, where there was no structure of management. And seeing as it's only when a small co-op was started there that the state and local authorities could could do anything. With the result of the co-op being established, there was a base on management that made it possible to provide a ferry for the place, and when there was a ferry was there, goods could be carried into the island, and made it possible for the Northwestern Health Board to build a dispensary and day centre for people, made it possible for Donegal County Council to build houses, which were the first local authority houses ever built on the island.
Rural development activities are now an important part of cooperative involvement in Ireland, and they're served by the Irish Cooperative Organisation Society, ICOS, whose Director General is John Tyrrell.
The cooperative movement in Ireland consists of about, in the agriculture and fishing area, consists of about 140 cooperatives. Their combined turnover will be over £6 billion in 1994, and they cover all sectors in the agriculture and fishing area, covering milk collection, milk processing, dairy manufacturing. It covers animal feed manufacture, fertilizer sales, all the supply of farm inputs, and providing a wide range of services then in the agricultural area. They're also involved in meat processing, in beef, pig meat and sheep processing as well, and livestock marketing, artificial insemination, farm relief services, every activity really relating to the agricultural area. They would contribute, we would estimate, something about 20% of our total net exports. They are a very important part of the rural economy because that's where they're based.
Who are the main co-ops in Ireland and how important are they to the economy of the country?
Well, we've a large number of co-ops, but the main ones would be, and if you take it in turnover terms, you'd have the Irish Dairy Board, which is a cooperative which is involved in the marketing of Irish dairy products overseas. We have other co-ops then like Avonmore, Kerry, Waterford, Dairy Gold, and then you have the what we would call the medium-sized co-ops like Nina, Tipperary, North Connacht Farmers, Lakeland, in the other parts of the country then as well. The other big benefit is that you have the development in rural areas, and you have the cooperatives have also, in addition to their core services of buying and processing farm produce, they also are involved in a range of rural development activities. And that's a very important activity for a lot of our cooperatives now, because the members are living in those rural areas, they want to see them developed and kept vibrant. So the cooperatives have put a lot of resources in terms of manpower and in terms of funding also into trying to encourage new activities to maintain people in rural areas.
What of the future, the challenges of the future?
Well, certainly I think the challenges will be no less than they were in the past, because we now have we're part of the European Community. We're also part of the wider context of trade, and we're part of the GATT, and we've had a recent agreement on the Uruguay round of the GATT, and that certainly poses a major challenge. Now, it also gives an opportunity to an extent, because it means that trade is being freed up, you have tariff barriers being removed, so there is access being given to some outside markets. The challenge will be to ensure that our economy does get benefits from that, and that the agricultural economy is not disadvantaged when the GATT is fully implemented over the next 6 years. I think another aspect, and I've referred to it briefly there in relation to rural development, the number of farmers has been declining. That has been a trend that has happened since the Industrial Revolution. It is a trend that's happening outside Ireland. We still have a very high dependence on the agricultural sector. And the challenge will be what is going to happen if that trend continues, or what can we do to arrest that decline? We don't want to see people leaving rural areas, but we've got to recognise that if there aren't opportunities for people there, they're not going to stay. So we've got to see if we can generate sustainable opportunities for people to live in those areas and to live with dignity.
In retrospect, how big a debt do you think is owed to Horace Plunkett and his vision?
I think an enormous debt is attributed to him, because I think he saw the potential that there was in the agricultural community, which nobody else at the time really fully appreciated. And I think you've got to understand that it was not easy for Plunkett to go and sell the message because of the very wide difference between his background and the background of the people that he was trying to convince. He was a Protestant and he was trying to persuade the Catholic farmers and the peasant farmers, as they were at the time, that they should combine in order to improve the lot of all of them. He wasn't a nationalist, and he was trying to persuade these nationalists to follow this particular message. He had no vested interest of his own. He had only got the best interests of the people at heart. And it took some time for that message to get across. And I think once they got that message across, you began to see once they got one or two co-ops set up, other people saw the advantages of it, and he persisted and he persuaded a large number of people then to follow the message that he was preaching, which was basically that you need to have a more scientific approach to the farming, you need to have a more business-like approach to the processing and the marketing of the product, and if you can combine the better farming and the better business, that as a result of that you'll get a better living standard. And that was summed up in his motto, better farming, better business, better living. And that, I think, is still true today.
In Leland Lyon's words, Plunkett was a medley of strange paradoxes, a combination of the man of business with the idealist, a poor speaker but an excellent publicist, an aristocrat of exquisite manners, perfectly at home with the cowboys on the range, a man whose hold on life was always precarious, but whose zest for living was inexhaustible. But beneath these contradictions were attributes of courage, strength of character, and a desire to serve. Above all, he had a concept of Ireland that was both national and international. In his friend Lady Fingal's words, Ireland had laid her burden on him.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.